That's my little puppy. So, I'd like to start call this meeting to order. And if you can do it, my little puppy in the background, we'll be okay. First off, I'd like to welcome Aldo Lampson, Veronzo. Aldo, did I pronounce that correctly?
You did.
Okay, good to have you. And I'm sorry that I don't think we can see your face, can we?
Nope.
Not tonight.
All right, Aldo. Well, not tonight, but we will. I had the opportunity of talking to Aldo a while ago, and I was glad to have him here. And I was glad for the expeditious movement that our county councilors made in getting this the spot filled. So, is there any comments before we get going here? All right.
Carl, actually, I have one comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
I have a comment on the open space timberland applications, more of a disclosure. Our firm has represented Susan Courtney in the past. I haven't, and she's one of the applicants. I haven't represented her personally. And I don't think she doesn't have any open files with our firm currently, but she's a past client. So I've talked to Christine Cook and she suggested I make a disclosure. Doesn't think it's something I need to recuse myself on, but I want to make that disclosure before the hearing in 2 weeks, but I also want to make it before the work session.
Okay, great, Steve. And again, if there's anybody else that needs to speak to anything of that nature, let me know or let Christine know and she can give you direction. So good to hear from everybody and hopefully we'll get to see each other virtually at the hearing. I know it's been a slow year to start off with, but as we get going here, hopefully we can kind of get some normalcy. So first up, Hunter, is Hunter going to open up, Sonia?
Yes. Okay. Hunter?
Hunter, are you ready?
I'm ready to proceed.
Okay, let's rock.
All right. Thank you, Planning Commission, for tonight. Bring you the current use applications for 2020-2021 year. Next slide, please.
Hold on. Hold on.
That works. So a little bit about the open space program for those that you may not know about it. It's a state legislator law that to support the development and preservations of these lands. And the legislator then created a property tax deferral program designed to help property owners. And we have that code in our Clark County Code 3.08, the open space taxation chapter. And we will only be discussing the open space land and timberland applications as farm and agriculture is not part of this review. Next slide, please. So a little bit of background, the administration of this program requires the coordination between the assessor's department and public works forestry department. Applications are received throughout the year and reviewed near the end of the calendar year preceding the year of the assessment for current use tax. And as required by RCW, current use assessment requests are processed in the same manner as a comprehensive plan amendment. And all requests for current use classification require the Planning Commission review and are approved then by the Clark County Council. And this is actually the 34th year that the county has reviewed current use applications. Next slide, please. So it was enacted in 1970 as it allows property owners to have their open space, farm and agricultural lands and timberlands valued at their current use rather than their highest and best use. And here are some numbers and as far as last August 13th of 2020, you can see the differences in values. And the map shows the locations of these properties. Next slide, please. And so here's some of the open space categories we have and their relationship to the Washington State open space categories. We have refined some of those criterias to be a little more stringent here in Clark County, but you can see the color relationship there. Next slide, please. And timberland classification is it's not an open space category. It stands on its own, and we do not have any open timberland applications tonight. Next slide, please. So of the requests, we received three open space assessments for the historical preservation of Clark County Code 3.08.060. And a little bit about that classification is based on the preservation of historical sites. And it's will be limited to historical sites and land containing structures of historical significance. So as long as they're listed on the local, state, and national historical registers and protected as such. And these properties can be less than 5 acres and only shall be in the effect of the approval of this application process. Next slide, please. So here's the first application, the Kellogg House. They've requested 0.33 acres of their property. The location is 9555 Southeast Image Lane. And an on-site review indicated that there is a house building on site, and it was built in 1965, and it is listed on the Clark County Heritage Register. And so therefore, the application then meets the code criteria in our Clark County code and recommend approval of this application. And next slide, please. Here's a picture of the property. Next slide, please. Here's the second application, Melvin's Men's Shop. It's was requested 0.1111 acres of the site and located at 901 Main Street. And the on-site review indicated that the building is on site and built in 1934 and listed on the Heritage Historical Register, and therefore meets the code criteria of our open space chapter and recommend approval of this application. Next slide, please. Here's a picture of that property. And next slide, please. And the third application, DeVos Motors Company Building, requested 0.14 acres of their property and is located at 500 Washington Street. The building is on site and built between 1927 and 1928 and listed on the register. And therefore, it meets our Clark County Code requirements, and we recommend approval of that property and application. Next slide, please. And a picture of that property. And next slide. And that ends our review of the open space applications, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Okay, I see Ron's hand.
Yeah, thank you, Hunter. Because these are all of historic preservation, I was wondering, it sparked my interest on the DuBois Motors building. I know in the past, there's been some discussion about that entire sold. If it transfers owners, but they still hold up the same criteria as far as keeping the historic preservation intact, would this transfer over with new ownership?
I do know that when a time of sale occurs, that there is a recording that it is kind of like an obligation. You are, you know, signing an agreement that you will continue that obligation to preserve the property. And if not, then you would be subject to removal of the program.
Okay. So if the building was altered, demolished, or whatever the case is, how would the county know?
Honestly, I'm not 100% how we would know, other than through our tax assessments.
All right, thanks.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Just a observation. Designation within the open space seems like it's an orphan placement in this. And I just, Hunter, do you have any background how it ended up in this particular category?
You mean the historical property tax deferral requirement?
Yeah. Why is it not standalone somewhere else? Why is it in with open space?
You know, it's in the Washington legislature, so it was through, it was passed by them, and then we adopted those criteria as one of theirs is to preserve historical and archaeological sites.
Yeah, and I agree. I get it. It just seems like an odd placement where to put it. So that's my only question.
Yeah, you'd have to, I guess, ask the legislator on that question.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Hunter.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you, Hunter. I appreciate your time and effort on that. Sonia, can you click up the agenda so I can see who's next?
Okay. And I believe Jenna is still working with Rod Swanson. I have Rod's PowerPoint, and I have a staff report. Is it possible?
Can we switch? Go to buildable lands.
We could do that.
Yeah, let's just flip those two.
Jose.
Are you muted?
He's not muted. Jose?
Sonia, this is Jeff Schnabel here. If you would like, if Jose is not available to jump in right here, and we need to,
yes,
go back to, if we want to go back to Rod's presentation, I'm happy to run through his slide.
Okay.
While we're waiting.
Right. I'll open up his slide. Hold
I
on.
I actually
here.
Was able to get in.
Hey, oh, there he is.
Yeah, I restarted my computer. I've shut it off and turned it back on again, and the WebEx link worked.
Okay. Hold on. Let me get your report. Hold on here.
So we're looking at the PowerPoint presentation?
Yes.
Yeah. What fun. Well, thanks for offering to do my presentation for me, Jeff.
Anytime.
That probably would have been better.
That I doubt.
Okay, here we go. Okay, can you see it, Rod?
I can see it. Do you want me to start presenting it?
Yes.
Oh, okay. This is so confusing. So I'm here to talk about the upcoming code and manual update for the Planning Commission hearing in a couple weeks. Next slide, please. Clark County is one of six municipalities in Western Washington that has an ecology-approved stormwater manual. One of the reasons we have this is because the stormwater permit that these six permittees are under, the phase one municipal permit, requires them to have an equivalent manual to the state manual or to use the state manual. And back in 2013 or 14, we opted to create our own manual here by combining a lengthy code section and a separate county manual that augmented the state manual and the state manual into a single manual. Next slide, please. So why are we updating the manual? Well, one of the main reasons is that the 2019 Ecology MPDES Municipal Stormwater Permit for Clark County and the other permittees required several changes to be made to the manual. Also, since we adopted the manual back in 2015-16, we found a number of technical or minor policy changes that we need to make for the manual. We've been accumulating those things for about 5 years now. And then there are numerous minor edits and clarifications that we've identified over the last few years. Next slide, please. So why we're doing it now? It's because we have to have the manual effective by July 1st of this year. And it also, that window provides an opportunity to make needed changes that we have. And the basic schedule is the Planning Commission hearing on March 18th. We'll have a council work session sometime in April and hopefully a hearing to adopt the manual changes in May. And actually, they're not manual changes, they're the actual manuals themselves. Next slide, please. So there's basically, along with the staff report, there are several attachments. One attachment, the table of changes, basically is a Rosetta Stone to all the changes that are made in the four manual books. Overall, the manual has about 1,500 pages in it. So we wouldn't want to have people going through there trying to find things in the manual. So as we were accumulating things that we wanted to change in the manual, that made a really good table of all the changes. And there's a small document that has code revisions in it. And that's an attachment. And then each of the four books is an attachment. And of course, the DNS is an attachment too. Next slide, please. Public involvement. What we did, the original manual, the 2015 manual, had an extensive public involvement program because we were really kind of starting from scratch, so to speak, with the manual, along with the mandatory things that were in the ecology manual. And for this update, we published a draft in May of 2020 before we submitted our changes to ecology, and involved mainly manual technical stakeholders, the DEEB, those type of people. And then we also put another draft, a public review draft, out in December of 2020. And that went out to the 1,200 plus people who are interested in Planning Commission activities. And to date, I think we've got three people who have made comments on the manual, and we've been able to use some of those comments. They're all engineers that have made those comments. They're technical in nature. Next slide, please. Ecology mandated changes. These are the things, some of these actually are improvements that make it easier for some folks with development projects. But One thing it does, the manual regulates redevelopment on urban properties if they're over 5,000 square feet, and it lowers the threshold, the financial threshold for when redevelopment triggers from 50% of the parcel value to 50% of the project site value. So you could have a large parcel with several buildings on it, and if you renovate one of those buildings, you could easily trigger it. It does provide a more liberal ability to move treatment and fluid control off-site, but there's some pretty strict requirements for where you can do that. But it might be possible for some people to use that, and a redevelopment would be a good example. Really, probably the most significant thing besides the redevelopment threshold is they completely redid the requirements for discharges to wetlands. I think, you know, talking to Brent Davis, I don't know anything about wetlands, but he said that the new requirements are probably a little clearer and simpler than the old ones, but they're still really difficult for some projects to deal with. And the erosion control requirements are updated slightly. And then there are things called source control BMPs, which are things that control pollution before it enters the storm drain system. A good example would be a roof over a fueling island so that spilled petroleum products don't get into a storm drain. And it allows them also to pipe the drain into sanitary sewer instead of into the storm drain. Another good example we have and recently put in place is putting roofs over dumpster enclosures so that they can put a drain in the dumpster enclosure that goes to sanitary sewer instead of the storm sewer. The 17 new requirements are pretty minimal. There are a lot of smaller things. Oh, God, what was one? BMPs for well drilling and BMPs for potable water line flushing, that type of thing. And another thing that's affects a few people is ecology requires that there be a sunset clause for the various editions of the manual. So after 5 years, a project that was vested under the 2015 will no longer be gaining its permitting if it hasn't started construction. And started construction basically means grading the site or installing utilities as defined in the permit. Next slide, please. Okay, so these are technical and minor policy changes. The technical change I would kind of characterize is changing something in the engineering design. A policy change might be, you know, adding a couple of new submittal requirements for the engineering plan submittals to help folks at the county review them easier. Or one example is we're asking people to put the entire stormwater system on one plan sheet so that we can more easily enter it into our GIS system. I'll just, you can read these if you want to. I'll just kind of skip over this slide. One thing that's kind of a significant change is the stormwater permit requires the county to regulate all construction projects during construction erosion control requirements. And on top of that, projects that disturb over an acre are required to get an NPDES stormwater permit from the Department of Ecology. And so we're trying to make it so that people can use the ecology permit to meet the county requirements, and people can still meet the county requirements if they don't have a ecology construction permit for smaller projects, and to simplify that whole process. Okay, next slide, please. I can't read the slides anymore. Gray covering them. I've got a document here I can look at. Okay, county-driven code changes. Now I can see it. We're changing our water quality ordinance, or updating it to make it a prohibited discharge to connect a project to our county storm sewer system without an approved stormwater site plan being implemented. And we made a minor clarification to the stormwater control code to require record drawings for engineered LID BMPs. That was a an omission error in that one. The third one is wrong. Let's skip that one. And then also there was a requirement for a zero rise floodplain in the stormwater code and manual, which really, it's been there since the 90s. It really should be in the flood hazard area code. So we're going to put it there. Next slide, please. And then I mentioned earlier that there's probably 80 or 90 minor revisions, and those are all in the change table. Okay, I think that is about it. Next slide. Yep. So I hear silence.
Any questions? Yeah. Do we have any questions?
Yeah, this is Ron Barca. Rod, I saw that permeable asphalt was removed from county roads. I'm assuming that those are traffic bearing roads out in the public right of way. Is permeable asphalt still an acceptable practice for parking and private property?
Yeah, we didn't. Public Works has been having a lot of trouble with permeable asphalt, just the quality of the product, you know, failing in residential subdivisions. The use of permeable pavement actually is deemed infeasible if the ADT is over 400. So that would be about, you know, 40 houses maybe the drain to it. But yeah, it would still be perfectly legal to use in private uses that aren't county right of way. And there's other types of permeable pavement that people can use, you know, in right of way. If you're doing a subdivision, you could put in, you know, modular permeable pavers or something really nice like that, or you could use asphalt as well, not asphalt, but concrete.
All right, thank you.
You bet. Nice to hear you're still there, Ron.
Hey, Rod.
Yeah.
Brian Halbert here. A question for you on technical policy changes. One of them was remove the 3-foot depth to water requirement from full dispersion.
Yes.
What I understand stormwater ponds or infiltration ponds need to be, the bottom of them need to be 3 feet above the highest point of a water table is what this is referring to.
Yeah, full dispersion is a low impact development BMP. That's the most preferred one. You can only use it on large lots that are rural, and it's generally only used for single home construction because it requires so much space. You wouldn't see it in a subdivision or a site plan. And what it is, it's we have the ability to lower the amount of impervious surface that you have to have in your stormwater site plan if you can fully disperse the water into native vegetation or into a pasture or cropland. Mm-hmm. And in the manual, it had in the ecology manual, it had some language that said you couldn't do that if the depth to water was less than 3 feet. And it pretty much made it impossible for people to figure out, well, it's not impossible, but you would have to get a geotechnical report to show that it wasn't less than 3 feet. So it makes it easier to use full dispersion in rural areas, which is a good thing.
Great.
Rod, a question in terms of discontinuing permeable asphalt, maybe changing to concrete. Is there an idea in terms of, is there a cost associated with that?
Well, I guess, you know, I'm not an engineer, but I will say the cost to replace failed permeable asphalt is probably not trivial. And there are, if permeable asphalt is feasible, people could probably use regular asphalt and then build a underground infiltration system to discharge the water if they wanted to do that. But obviously, you know, installing modular pavers is probably quite a bit more expensive than asphalt. And I'm sure concrete is more expensive too. The problem with the asphalt is the binding agent in it isn't strong enough to keep it from being compacted. Also, it ravels, as they call it, you know, when people turn on it, it'll come apart. Mm-hmm. It's just not really the ideal thing for, at least in this area, the the people who provide the asphalt haven't been very successful at making something that works. And it's been a really painful issue for people in public works that have to work with development projects and then deal with the aftermath of the failed asphaltic concrete.
Rod, Brian Halbert again.
Yeah.
You mentioned that it might be possible for a project site to be under the county's MPDES permits and not have to do one for an individual site.
Well, what I was trying to say is that under our permit and under our code, every project that triggers minimum requirement two, which is erosion and sediment control, even if it's, you know, theoretically putting a fence post in would do it, they are regulated under our permit, no matter how big they are. And once they get to a certain size, an acre, then they have to, under the National, Clean Water Act requirements that are imposed by ecology, they have to get erosion control plan. And what we're trying to do with the changes is make it so that all the BMPs that are in the ecology manual can just be used if somebody wants to do their county standard erosion control plan. Mm-hmm. And people can use their ecology plan to meet the county requirements if they have an ecology permit.
And that's a site under 1 acre.
A site under 1 acre is regulated by the county. A site over 1 acre is regulated by the county and ecology. That's kind of the problematic thing.
Okay, got it. Thanks for that clarification.
It's confusing.
Yeah.
Any other questions or comments?
Yeah, this is Ron again.
Okay.
Rod, I think just for the purposes of saying that there's probably going to be a larger audience than just the engineers and the planning commission, when we go through all of this, could you just preface in the very beginning that BMP meaning best management practices? If somebody doesn't know that right up front, they're going to be following through all of these slides, wondering what that is throughout the whole process.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. I thought about that as I was looking at the PowerPoint earlier today.
Yeah, I think it'd be helpful. Thanks.
It would be, yeah.
Okay. Any other questions for Rod? Rod, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sonia, can you click back over to that? I can just go to there. That's fine. Go to Jose. Is Jose there, Sonia?
Yes. Jose?
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
All right.
The floor is yours.
All right.
Can I say something here real quick before we start? I'm not quite sure what is causing the gray patches in front of the slides. But we lose a portion of the slides with whatever mouse activity is going on. So I don't know whether, that's Sonia, if that's you or somebody else, but we lost a portion of it during Rod's presentation.
I thought it was WebEx.
I don't think it is.
Is it better now?
It's good now. Yeah, it's good right now. Thanks.
You can go to the next slide, Sonia.
Let's see. Did you get it?
Not yet.
Screen frozen, Sonia.
Can you see the screen?
We can see it, but it hasn't moved to the next slide yet.
Oh, well, mine has.
Okay.
There's two windows open. You might be looking at a different one that's being shared.
Okay. Jenna, can you move it?
If you give me a minute, I will share my screen. I will try to do that. Thank you all for your patience. Okay. And almost there. All right. Go ahead, Jose.
All right, thanks. Good evening, commissioners. Jose Alvarez, project manager on Build the Land project. This is a PowerPoint presentation that we shared actually with council yesterday morning. And this is just sort of a culmination of the work that was done by the Global Lands Project Advisory Committee. So we're just kind of go over what the purpose of sort of the buildable lands are, the overview of the PAC process, a summary of the recommendations, and a couple of items that were still outstanding where we couldn't get to a recommendation partly due to time restrictions. And then sort of what the next steps are in the process. Next slide, please. So really the Buildable Lands Report is a backwards look to see how we've done in the last 5 years since our last Buildable Lands Report, which was 2015, to see how we've grown and whether whether we're meeting our density targets that we established when we adopted the last plan, and to see whether we can accommodate the growth that's projected for the remainder of the 20-year plan. So the vacant buildable lands model, the VBLM, is really the tool that we use to calculate capacity for the different urban growth areas. And so the focus of the committee was really working on updates to that model and the methodology. There were some new guidelines from the state that sort of had an emphasis on showing your work and being evidence-based. Next slide, please. All right, so we've had a group that was appointed by council, started with 14 members. We lost two through the process. We met 8 times between December and 2019 and January 2021. And 6 of the 8 meetings were remote meetings, such as this, which were a bit of a challenge to convey a lot of sort of technical information. The group was really pretty good and had a good discussion, and Ron participated in that. We had sort of 9 topics that were related to the VBLM refinements that we sort of addressed. There were 19 recommendations. The majority of those were supported by a majority of the advisory committee members. And there were 4 that we'll go over in a little more detail that we have the range of perspectives. We couldn't get to the majority. I think the committee established the 2/3 majority as a recommendation. So that's what we needed to move a recommendation to council. Next slide. Actually, and then the next. So the recommendations, the land classifications, these were indexing the building value threshold. It seems like every time we update this methodology, we don't index the value. And so we're having to always fall behind. And so we just thought it would be a good idea to just build that into the model so we don't have to update it continually. So that's what the first bullet point's referencing. So it sort of moves with trends in property increases, value increases in the county. The second bullet point is the new classification for small underutilized lots. Right now the model excludes anything less than an acre. And we had noticed there'd been some developments on properties between a half an acre and an acre. And so we wanted to create a new classification, and the assumption was that in those comp plan designations that were urban high, which is where you'd get your multifamily, your medium density, and your multifamily, that 10% of redevelopment would happen in that urban density. So it would be 10% of those properties that were between a half acre and an acre. And then for the urban low would be 5% of those properties we would assume would have some sort of development. The new classification for platted lots is really looking at sort of trying to distinguish vacant land that's already been through the development process. So right now, if you have a new subdivision and you have 100 lots and they're 5,000 square feet each, we treat that the same as an undeveloped raw land that hasn't been through the process. And so it just made more sense to be able to distinguish that these lots are already in existence, and we can take that acreage out of the sort of the front end of the model. So that's what the vacant platted lots is. Currently, we exclude properties that are tax exempt. So that would include housing authority lands, but they're in the business of creating housing. So it didn't make a whole lot of sense to exclude them. So that's what we're doing there, is including properties owned by the housing authority, so that if they're vacant, we can estimate there'd be some likelihood for residential growth there. Next slide. So on the employment side, similar with the indexing the building value, we also, the classification of undeveloped properties, if there's a existing business, we're going to treat it as underutilized as opposed to being vacant. And then the lot size minimum for commercial land, a lot of times in particularly in Vancouver, the older downtown, there's lots that are less than 5,000 square feet that can be that are vacant and can be used for development, and the model excludes those because the cutoff is the 5,000 square foot. There are some in the other jurisdictions. It's usually in the older commercial downtown areas, and then the similarly, the housing authority and the ports, Vancouver and Kamis-Washougal do have some commercially zoned land that would account for some employment. And so we didn't want to exclude those from the model. Currently, I think they're accounted for in the industrial model, but not in the commercial model, but they do have some commercial properties. So we just wanted to include those as well. Next slide, please. Oh, there you go. So in one of the areas that we know that the model was not doing a very good job was the development, redevelopment in the downtown area of Vancouver. The model did not account for any of the residential growth in the downtown area because it was zoned commercial. The only areas where we expect residential in a sort of commercial zone is a mixed use area. So we've been really under counting, we're not counting at all of the growth in the Vancouver commercial area downtown. And the city had also passed some ordinances that allows for some additional residential in some of their commercial areas outside of downtown. What we decided to do was to distinguish between those two areas, because what we observed was that the densities in the downtown commercial core were much higher than what you would find in the other commercial areas within the city. So we looked at sort of redevelopment and came up with a 5% residential redevelopment factor inside the city center and 1% outside. And then that 30% residential in the city center and 15% outside of the city center. This, let's see. Next slide. So in terms of market factor, we kept the existing market factor that we call it a never to convert factor, but for our vacant land, it's 10%, and for our underutilized, it's 30%. We looked at a couple of things to try to ground truth the market factor. We looked at some of historical data and also some areas where we had seen development, particularly on the east side of between 99th Street and 119th north-south, and between 503 and 152nd, where there's been a lot of development over the last sort of 12, 13-year period, and look to see what's developed and what's sort of remained undeveloped. And so that was kind of the sample area that we chose to look at to see if the market factor kind of trends were holding up. And it was generally about right. Next slide. So the population capacity, this is really about achieved density. And for most of the jurisdictions, they were meeting or above the targeted densities. So let's see, Richfield, Battleground, Camas have target densities of about 6 dwelling units per acre. They were able to meet, they were meeting those. La Center is at 4, and I think Washougal is also at 6. So all of the smaller jurisdictions were meeting their density targets. The Vancouver UGA was an interesting anomaly where, you know, the unincorporated urban growth area was just about eight. The target for the Vancouver UGA is about 8 units per acre. And it's a combination of the city of Vancouver and the unincorporated Vancouver UGA. So, you know, Salmon Creek, Phillida, Hazeldale, and out east is what that consists of. What we'd observed is because of partially the development downtown, the city of Vancouver was hitting a density of about 17 units an acre, and the unincorporated county was just under 8. So, you know, combined, that's about 10.5. So the recommendation that we were making was we have a single density target that I had mentioned, and what we thought would be better was to break that out into some categories. We have urban low, urban media, urban high, and then some of the mixed-use categories that we have data for the different jurisdictions. And when we broke that out, I think it just gives us a better detail on what's happening, and then it lets us account for what's going on in the city a little more specifically to address some of that development on the commercial land. For example, the city of Vancouver, I think within the downtown area, is averaging about 100 units per acre, and their commercial outside of downtown, I think it's between 24 and 30. I think it's close to 30. So we just thought it would be best to separate those out so that when you average those, the other issue is that the number of acres within the Vancouver UGA is about 5-to-1 unincorporated area to the city. And so if you were to use that combined higher density number of 10.5, it's going to overestimate how much capacity you have, as opposed to just focusing the higher density in the smaller acreage for the city of Vancouver. There was, so that was one of the areas where we weren't able to get to a recommendation on, but I'll come back to that in a second. Next slide. So the employment density essentially kept the existing density assumption, mostly looking our current assumptions are 9 units per acre for industrial land and 20 units per acre for commercial. It was challenging getting data from the state on employment. So we kind of looked at what other jurisdictions were doing, and it seemed like our current projections were reasonable within the range that we saw from other jurisdictions. And then, so that's why we decided to retain the existing employment densities. Infrastructure gaps was another area that was sort of a new issue that the Commerce guidelines wanted us to address. You know, seeing if land was, if there was sufficient infrastructure in place for land to be served and developed. What we did was really talk to the cities if they had identified any infrastructure gaps where they had land in their jurisdiction or their urban growth areas that they couldn't serve within the 20-year time frame. They all replied that they could serve those areas within the 20-year time frame consistent with their capital facilities plans. So we're not proposing any modifications based on a lack of infrastructure. The town of Yackel has no sewer. They have no urban density target, so there's no change proposed for that. There was interest in, we talked about the rural capacity. In the buildable land guidelines is really, the focus is on urban density and meeting those urban density targets, but there was some interest about the rural. So we shared with the group the methodology we use to estimate rural capacity. We didn't have any proposed recommendations. We didn't really get a lot of feedback from the group about the methodology itself, but about other things that were outside of the scope of what we were looking at in terms of the methodology and what was in the buildable land guidelines. There were some other policy issues that were brought up that would be better to deal with when we're looking to update the comprehensive plan. Next slide, please. One more. So the these are the four areas where we couldn't really. The first item is accounting for excess and rearage acres. That really applies to sort of commercial and industrial land. And it's something that the assessor, I'm losing my video, but the assessor was really something that they track, and on certain properties where they feel there's excess land that could be developed is what they consider excess. And then the there's also rearage acres sort of at the back of the properties. And so they have different assumptions, I think, on the excess. The 75% of those excess acres that they've identified could potentially contain additional development. And on the rearage, I believe it was 20% that they thought could get some additional employment capacity. So we proposed that. I think we didn't get, I think 7 of 12 members voted in favor of that. So there wasn't that didn't satisfy our 2/3 majority requirement, but we just wanted to share that information with the counselors and the group. On the population capacity, essentially is what I mentioned before in terms of the density issues with really the city of Vancouver and whether to keep one target density number or to break it out by sort of it's a composite of the comp plan designations, urban medium or urban low and urban high, and some of the other mixed use designations. Critical lands and infrastructure, we this is where we spent a lot of time. These are two interrelated things. We had a consultant look at I'll start with the infrastructure set-asides. The development community had brought forward some samples of developments and what they estimated as infrastructure for those subdivisions. We had our consultant look at that. One of the issues was that changes in the stormwater regulations that necessitated larger ponds and therefore more land that was needed to be set aside for stormwater. Our consultants looked at that and were able to verify that that was the case, that there was more land that was needed for stormwater. One of the issues that we sort of discovered later in the process is the way that the development community calculated the infrastructure deduction, say on a plat, was to exclude the critical lands and then do the infrastructure percentage based on the developable land in the plat. And that was a different methodology than we had been using. Completely valid to do that. But in order to do that, we have to really kind of had to tweak how we treat the critical lands. I think there was some confusion. We had been treating critical lands as sort of a market factor, as opposed to those lands that are protected and that can't be developed in a plat. One of the challenges is that the what we use is the GIS critical layer, and it really identifies more land as being critical than sort of actually shows up as critical land in a plat. And so we looked at some of the historical subdivisions and were able to come up with an infrastructure deduction, a critical land deduction of about 40% over the last 10, 20 years on average. It sort of vacillates up and down, but on average, that's what the deduction is shown. We did have some issues with categorizing, and I think sometimes the stormwater facilities can be located in critical lands, particularly in the areas where you're going to have wetlands. And so I know Brent is going to update the critical areas ordinance. And through ecology, it seems like there's going to be further limitations that the stormwater facilities are going to have to be located on the outer 25% of the wetland buffers. So in terms of critical lands and infrastructure set asides, it seems to support the recommendations that we were making. I know there was a bit of confusion in our last meeting, and then Ron could talk to that, but I think from the conversation we heard at that meeting, there were some issues about how we were looking at critical lands and potential double counting, and I think we've tried to clarify that in this sort of last recommendation we made. Can we go to the next slide? I completely lost my video. I can't see that. What slide are we on?
This is accounting for excess and rearage.
Slide 14.
I just talked about it all. I think gone through everything. Does anybody have any questions? And I'll go through the sort of next steps.
Yeah, I am wondering when we do this presentation, whether it is valuable for everybody concerned to have an understanding about slide 6 and slide 7, the index values. Maybe you can express what those values are, and that way indexing would make a bit more sense, I think, by not having any values associated with the discussion. Sure. It just seemed a little nebulous to me.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Jose, this is Brian. I have several questions. One is, what's the expectation from us regarding the outstanding issues? And the outstanding issues are those issues that are under additional potential refinements. There wasn't a majority support for it. So what's the expectation for us in terms of, and what are we supposed to do about that?
Right, so we went to council and we want to get some direction from them on sort of, we don't want them to, well, we want them to give us some direction on to, you know, what a recommendation should be so that when we have a public hearing, people can sort of comment about that and not leave it sort of open-ended. And so we do have, you know, recommendation. It didn't have majority support, but either, you know, we move that forward or take it off the table. But we're definitely going to need to get just to clarify. It would be good just to have something out there, whether it's, you know, whomever's recommendation it is, but just to have something concrete so that people can either comment, you know, against or for, or come up with some alternative that can be put out there.
Okay, all right. So that one is still evolving. The other question is on population capacity. To me, that sounds more like a county council policy, as opposed to, you know, so, you know, our recommendation.
Well, the population capacity.
Right, in terms of achieved density versus target density.
Yeah.
The approach.
Right. Yes. So the target density is already established in is adopted and is in our comprehensive plan. The achieved density, in terms of the buildable lands report that we have to send to the state, it required that we show what the capacity is based on the achieved density. And so based on that, whether we have sufficient capacity for the remainder of the 20-year period. I think what we're looking sort of forward to is when we start this process up again for the next 20-year plan, should we revert back to those target densities? Should we kind of modify those? In our vacant buildable lands model, should we be using this achieved density to sort of set the foundation for the capacity? So they're kind of, they're the same thing, but they're going to be used in two different ways.
And so Jose, so you're saying what I'm saying. So as opposed to who makes that decision?
The council.
Right.
All of these decisions, yeah. All of these council decisions, yeah.
The bigger questions I have, Jose, is how does the overlay and the zoning impact some of the impacts that you guys have identified in terms of adding 500 gross acres to the land classifications employment? Where is it? I also saw under the land classification residential. So when you take into account the zoning, how does that impact in terms of adding gross and net acres? Yeah, and I think it also feeds into the discussion in terms of rearage and excess, or the same thing in terms of it's good to have, you know, not good, but if you're saying there's this additional acre or half acre, wherever it is, but if it's not zoned proper, not zoned to do the development, such as what they've done in Vancouver in terms of changing the zoning so they can have more mixed use. Have you taken into account that, you know, some of this may not be, you know, it's not currently available because of the zoning?
Right. So what we're looking at in terms of like the half acre and 1 acre, we're looking at a small percentage of that based on what we've seen in the past. And we're looking... We generally, the acreage is aggregated. So they're either urban low or urban high is going to be, urban high are the more, the higher density zones. So I think that's why I had a higher percentage of redevelopment because those will be able to redevelop into a higher density. Whereas you wouldn't have that same on the urban low zones. And that's why there was a distinction between the percentage of redevelopment.
And then one more question, and it's kind of two combined. When we were talking about the infrastructure set aside and then the critical areas. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like, at least to me, what I thought I heard, I was like, there's two pieces of that. One is trying to reach agreement on the data, the actual number, and then what the methodology is. So the data, what I'm hearing is there's some discussion of what that deduction number should be. And then secondly, in terms of the methodology, if you can explain that a little bit better to me in terms of the project approach. I understand from a developer, from the developer, what you have here is that they're taking a net number from the total gross and using that number and then doing a deduction. And is the project team agreeing with that, or is there a different methodology?
Right. Yes, we're moving in that direction. Our problem has been that the way the model is set up now, we are coming at it from when we looked at, we use a 27.7% deduction for infrastructure. And when GIS was doing that methodology, they were looking at the stormwater and roads as infrastructure over the entire area of the site, not excluding the critical land. The way
The issue we had was that in the aggregate, when we're looking at this at, you know, the 10,000 foot level, we don't know for each site how much of critical land is going to go into a particular subdivision and actually be critical land. And that was the distinction that we were having. And that's why we weren't doing that, because we didn't have the knowledge that developers have when they're actually doing a development site and those wetlands are delineated, and you know exactly how much to exclude. And so we were doing, we were coming at this historically where we used to have a critical land deduction of 100%, where, you know, if it's critical land, the assumption is that it shouldn't be developed and we shouldn't count it as developable land. Over time, that modified into a 50% deduction, because we had observed that actually critical land had been developing, and that quite a bit of it. And so we should be accounting for that. What we're trying to be more clear on is that it seems like if the development community is going to look at this based on that plat basis, we should also look at it based on, you know, what we've observed over time as a plat, as opposed to the way we have been looking at it previously, where we weren't really accounting for the actual percentage of critical that was in the plat. Does that help?
Well, so to me, it sounds like, Jose, you guys haven't come up with and finalized that methodology then. You're still working on it.
No, we're done. It's just a matter of whether it's accepted or not. But we're essentially moving towards what the development community is doing.
Thank you, Jose.
Sure. Any other questions?
Just one other question real quick, Jose. Sure. You guys are going to get some additional information to council. Are we going to get that information too?
The additional information? I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear that.
Oh, sorry about that, Jose. So there was some additional information that was requested by council, I thought. I heard you say that, you know, they wanted some, yes, some more information. Are we going to get that information too?
Yeah, I can provide that. Most of the information they've asked for is how did members vote on particular items. So we're going to summarize that, and yeah, we can share that with you as well.
Jose, Brian Halbert here. You talked about achieving our density or targeting our density requirements. And do you have an idea of how we are doing with our density requirements on that 20-year plan?
Yeah, so each of the jurisdictions is meeting or exceeding the density targets that are in the plan.
And if they are meeting or exceeding their density requirements, does that help them to move forward with further moving the growth boundaries? Is that a part of what that process will ultimately?
So there's two separate things. The buildable lands report is looking back. It's a backwards look to see how we're doing. What's going to happen is that, so if we're meeting density targets and we have sufficient land to accommodate the population that we were planning for in 2016, okay, that's fine, that's great. But in a year or two, we're gonna get a new population projection. that's going to exceed what we had planned for before, more than likely. And so that's when we look at this vacant buildable land model to see how much capacity we have relative to that new population projection. And so that's going to be a 2024 to 2044 plan. And so those are the two separate items. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so, Jose. I think what you're saying is because we are meeting our current density requirements, the plan, that we could be running out of buildable lands and need to be considering expanding the UGB as the population is growing faster than expected.
Right. So, well, the thing about the buildable lands guidelines is really about, you know, if you're not meeting your density targets, what steps can you take to try to meet them? So I don't think we're going to have to answer that question because we are meeting them. Okay. And the population projection that we had, it seems like we're growing faster than the projection was. So it's, you know, whether we still have enough, we should have enough capacity to meet that that 20-year target. The real question is going to be for the next 20 years. And that's when we'll look at whether we have enough land and whether we need to expand the urban growth boundary.
Okay, perfect. Thanks, Jose.
Sure.
Yeah, Jose, Brian Halbert here again. It's an incredible report, and I can see why it's been a year in the making, and what a challenging a look at properties with all the overlays to put this report together. It's, you know, just reading some of the other information that was attached to this. It's an amazing piece of work.
Thank you. Yeah, and good staff and consultants working on that.
And committee members.
Yeah, don't want to forget those. It was a good conversation.
Jose, can you just one more time expand on what Brian was saying in terms of if we're exceeding target, or, you know, actual what we're achieving,
mm-hmm.
and you get the population numbers, are we saying then that we are able to accommodate this the population within existing UGAs?
Not yet. So let's see how I can put this. We're sitting at about 500,000 folks right now, based on the 2020 OFM number. The population that we were, I think, planning for 2035 was about 538,000, I'm not mistaken. And then, so what this report is just going to say, you know, based on the BBLM and our reaching our targets, you know, we have capacity, we're meeting our density targets, and based on the density and how much land we have, we have enough land, or we don't have enough land, to accommodate the population that we were planning for to get to 538,000. In 2020,
the state is going to put out a new 20-year population projection that will be far in excess of 538,000. And so what we are going to need to do is evaluate how much growth the council will pick, you know, one of the the state will give us a range. We'll pick a population number, and then we'll determine how much how many people we need to accommodate and measure the existing supply of land and those density based on that density, how much capacity we have. So the driver is going to be the new population number and the new out years of growth in determining whether we need to expand our urban growth boundaries.
Yeah, Jose, this is Ron. For the Planning Commission, I guess talking about the aspect of exceeding our density targets, maybe you look at it in the context that it says we're being more efficient within the confines of the existing land inventory that we have available. So we are putting more people into the projected area than we initially thought by exceeding the targets or meeting those targets, is saying we're being as efficient as we felt we needed. So getting back to what Bryant said before, density is also a policy decision. And it's one of the things that council will have to weigh in on. But by us meeting or exceeding our density targets, we are doing exactly what we said we were going to be doing with the plan. The concept that more people are arriving than the plan talked about plays a role on the need to keep the density up in all of the areas to be able to accommodate until we reach a place where it says that we expand the urban growth boundaries. But part of our role is really going to be clearly understanding on the expansion of those urban growth boundaries, what the county can afford. So it isn't just a matter of saying, yeah, there's more land out there, we're going to open it up. That's why we have these density targets, is to try and keep us in a process that says municipalities and the county itself are able to actually supply the necessary resources and services that are required. So yeah, we're hitting our targets, and that's well and good for us. That just says we're being efficient.
Ron, Brian here. It sounds like what you're speaking to is concurrency, and that you when you grow, you need to grow with all the infrastructure, schools, roads, services for those, for that growth, employment or residential. And these numbers show that we can grow efficiently, I think is what you're saying.
Yeah, concurrency is the state definition of concurrency. But yeah, that's the general gist of the matter, is just like when Jose was talking about the idea of urban high density and urban low density in the residential sections out in the Vancouver UGA, that there's opportunities in the urban high densities to additionally get more building in there. And that helps us when we're able to do that.
Mm-hmm. So Ron, this is, I like this discussion. So the question I have for then Jose then is, when we look at adding these acres and looking at this quote unquote additional capacity, is that, are we looking at it in terms of from an optimal standpoint, or shouldn't we have more of a conservative approach, so that, you know, when we look at this, You know, we're not overestimating what we think we would have in terms of additional acres if we change some of these classifications.
I think that, let me see. We're really trying to take a balanced approach. Like our assumptions have to be evidence-based. There's, requirements that sort of like the way we use market factor. We can't assume that all land will develop, because we know that people are going to be willing to sell their land. So some of those, more sort of common sense things have to go in. We, one of the discussions we had, one of the recommendations from city was like looking at their commercial zone collectively, and not distinguishing between the downtown and sort of the outlying commercial areas. You take approaches like that, you're going to overestimate capacity in some of those outlying areas. So there's got to be some level of refinement that sort of goes into that. And I think, I take the point. I don't think we've generally, there hasn't been a lot of changes in zoning. Really, the issue with the city of Vancouver, their downtown plan has been in existence since 2007, and it's just kind of been dormant up until the last few years. Things are coming into play, and you're seeing a tremendous amount of growth in those areas, and we need to capture that. And it was a challenge earlier where, when we had the plan in 07, we didn't anticipate it. We weren't accounting for it. There was really no track record of it happening. So that's sort of the tension and, if you are more aggressive and make assumptions that something will happen and you don't have any track record of it, you can overestimate the capacity. And so it's a balancing act between those things.
We ready to do next steps?
Sure. Mm-hmm. So we had the work session with council yesterday. Didn't put your PC in here. Looks like we're trying to have another council time in March 24th. To get some direction from council. We need to talk to Oliver about the sort of the rest of this, but we're looking at having, we need some direction to resolve some of these items so that we can actually run the model and finish the report, and then that will come to the Planning Commission sometime in May, and then the hearing with the council in June, and submittal to the state by the end of June.
Jose, this is Ron. So do you anticipate the Planning Commission needing to deliberate on some of the outstanding issues and give recommendations?
Initially, it wasn't. I need, that's what I need to get some direction on.
Yeah. I think initially we wanted to go to council and have them adopt a resolution on that and then come back to you guys with the report. I need to confirm that with Oliver.
All right, thanks.
Yep. That's all I've got. Any questions? Any other questions?
Jose, this is Brian. Hey, no, I appreciate the good work, and I know you. No, you don't have a crystal ball, so it's not written out there somewhere for you. So I appreciate the work, my friend.
Thank you. I appreciate the question.
Okay, thank you, Jose. Any other questions or comments? Okay, Sonia, is there anything else on the agenda?
No, that's it. Unless the Planning Commission member has any other comments.
Anything for the better? Next hearing will be March 18th, is that correct?
March 18th at 6:30 p.m.
Sounds good. Okay, fellas, we'll see you then.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.